began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens because we want to live as decent human beings in America. Thank you.
That was the voice of Fannie Lou Hamer. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Haley Payson on the radical legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. Fannie Lou Hamer was a fighter for equality and justice who said, "If I fall, I'll fall 5 feet 4 inches forward in the fight for freedom." Going against entrenched racism, she was able to accomplish much in gaining voting rights for African Americans. She died in 1977 at the age of 59. Voting rights remain under attack. In the old days, it was poll taxes, literacy tests, and KKK terror. Today, racist legislatures suppress voter turnout, gerrymander districts, limit places where you can cast your ballot, and crucially, impose voter ID laws. A driver's license is often required. Blacks are the main target of these new restrictions. According to one study, 37% of African Americans do not have a valid driver's license, compared to 16% of whites. The struggles that Fannie Lou Hamer faced have taken on new shapes and forms. To talk about Fannie Lou Hamer is Haley Payson. She's a member of the International Socialist Organization in upstate New York and organizes with the Rockland Coalition to End the New Jim Crow. She spoke at the International Socialist Conference in Chicago. And now, Haley Payson.
I actually am wondering, before I get into the meat of my talk, how many people here have heard of someone named Crystal Mason? Has anyone heard that name before? Okay, well, I wanted to start because Crystal Mason is a black woman from Texas. When Crystal went to vote, she was informed that her name was not on the voting rolls, so she filled out a provisional ballot. As it turned out, no one had informed Crystal that because of her felony record, she had lost her right to vote. For attempting to exercise what she thought was her right, she was sentenced to 5 years in prison for voter fraud. This is not an incident from the 1960s. This happened this year in 2018. I start with this story because it illustrates the ways that while the struggles of the civil rights and black power era succeeded in ending the racist system of Jim Crow segregation, capitalism has a way of adapting racism as a tool of divide and rule. And it illustrates the continued relevance of learning the many lessons from previous struggles against racism, which were never merely about the right to vote, but about the question of how to win self-determination. This story also brings to mind a quote by the historian and anthropologist Stephen Jay Gould that folks here have probably heard before. It goes, quote, "I am somehow less interested in the weight and convolutions of Einstein's brain than in the near certainty that people of equal talent have lived and died in cotton fields and sweatshops." This is a forceful indictment of the conditions that capitalism creates for all workers, and especially for black workers, given the centrality of that oppression within the society from the very beginning. But this only captures one side of the picture. On the other side, I think it's equally important what happens when people begin to resist these conditions. Because for us as socialists, we believe that ideas change through struggle, including ideas about who has the right to be a leader in society, who has the right to actually decide their own fate. right, and who's capable of doing so. And I think really there's no better example of that than the life and legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. The person this talk is about. She's a Black woman from Mississippi who quite literally worked in the cotton field of the Jim Crow South. She's someone whose talents and capacity as a leader may never have been revealed if there hadn't been a mass movement against racism. But because there was a movement, and because of her choice to participate, even at great personal cost, she became a national figure, not only as a victim of Southern racism, but as an activist dedicated in every fiber of her being to the Black freedom struggle. She became famous for her ability to movingly articulate the plight of Black people in the South, while also inspiring ordinary people from her own community to join that struggle, despite the enormous threats of economic reprisal, repression, and even death. And she was fully committed to the idea that the oppressed, those most impacted by racism, should be the ones active in changing their own conditions. However, like most figures of the civil rights era, her legacy has been largely sanitized to the extent that people even know about her at all. Instead, the focus tends to be on how she refused to hate her enemies, or how, you know, she overcame personal hardship through hard work and perseverance. So a particularly conservative narrative that anyone across the political spectrum can embrace. But I think this totally does a disservice to her actual work and ignores the full scope of what she stood for. In fact, few people probably realize that she was considered the movement's most powerful orator, second only to Martin Luther King. Part of this reflects the ways that leading Black women in particular have been erased or overlooked, such as Ella Baker, Diane Nash, and many lesser-known activists who made up the rank and file of the Southern Civil Rights Movement. But another reason for this erasure is that Hamer was willing to stand up not only to Mississippi's overtly racist Jim Crow establishment, she also took the fight against racism nationally, challenging President Lyndon B. Johnson and the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, who gave lip service to civil rights while really doing the opposite. And she wasn't afraid to criticize the moderate wing of the civil rights movement, whose largely middle-class leadership often worked to contain the more radical demands of the poor and working-class activists with whom Hamer allied herself. By contrast, Hamer insisted on the right of those directly facing oppression to represent and stand up for themselves. Nevertheless, whereas sections of the movement eventually embraced Black separatism, Hamer never saw Black self-determination as counterposed to solidarity with the oppressed, and insisted on the need for a multiracial movement to fight racism in the South and throughout the entire country. Most importantly, I think, Hamer's impact came not from distinguishing herself from masses of ordinary Black people, but because as a poor, uneducated Black woman herself, she shared the experiences of some of the most exploited and oppressed people in the country and asserted their right to speak on their own behalf. It was these commitments that informed her efforts to win voting rights in the South, to run for elected office on multiple occasions, and to pursue multiple projects aimed at breaking the back of segregation, all of which gained her a reputation as principled and uncompromising. So I want to start with Hamer's early life, what really informed, I think, her entry into the movement. She was born on October 6, 1917, the youngest of 20 children to James Lee, who was a Baptist preacher and bootlegger, which he was not ashamed about, and neither was she, and Lou Ella Bramlett Townsend, who was a sharecropper and a domestic worker in white homes. Very many people, the overwhelming majority of people who lived and worked in the Delta and happened to be Black. In Mississippi, more than any other state, there was ultimately what people called a closed society. Some people refer to it as America's dungeon for its devotion to upholding white supremacy. In the region of the state known as the Delta, a minority class of landowning whites had gained near total domination by rolling back the gains of radical Reconstruction, which was a brief period following the Civil War, during which the popular abolitionist movement had ushered Blacks into political office in a country that had only recently held Blacks as slaves, among other progressive advantages, which is a period that Du Bois referred to as a moment in the sun. The result of this backlash was that this minority of whites owned the overwhelming majority majority of the land, while the majority black population worked it under conditions little removed from slavery. And it trapped families for generations in the same brutal backbreaking work, sometimes in 100-degree heat for poverty wages. And for those who don't know, sharecropping was basically a system where people worked, black people worked the land. They did so, they create, you know, produced crops, and in exchange for giving the profits from the crops to the white landowners, they were allowed to live on the land. Sounds like a fair and even exchange, right? Actually, they were ultimately utterly exploited. This was for, you know, almost nothing. And this system was upheld by racist laws and tactics designed to preserve political domination by those most devoted to white supremacy. And if that failed, to deter blacks' resistance through violence, both legal and extra-legal. And this was organized from the top down. It wasn't just kind of, efforts by random white people. It was actually something that was encouraged from the very top of that society. And I'll give you a pretty gruesome example. There's a senator, Theodore Bilbo, in 1947, who was the head of the Democrat, you know, was part of the Democratic primary campaign there, and he said to a white audience, quote, "If you let a handful go to the polls," in other words, if you let a handful of black people go to the polls in July, "there will be two handfuls in 1947, and from there it will be a mighty surge. But you and I know what's the best way to keep the nigger from voting. You do it the night before the election." In fact, fewer blacks were registered in Mississippi in 1964 than had been in 1896. Part of what made resistance harder was that Mississippi was a state where blacks were the most tied economically to the minority wealthy white ruling class. And there was less of a tradition of a middle class than in some of the other states, meaning that there was, you know, more of an economic tie, less independence. Although, fair to say, the black middle class that did exist was actually so tied, you know, was so precarious in its position that they were really unwilling to challenge segregation in any meaningful way. In addition, new technology and mechanization of the work that had traditionally been done by sharecroppers led to fewer jobs being available and a surplus of black labor. So blacks either had to leave the South to actually find jobs and also escape the most brutal racism, or face increased poverty and malnutrition, which many people were trapped into. And Hamer's life exemplified virtually all the conditions that the poorest black Mississippians faced under this system. When she was six, she was trapped into sharecropping by a landowner who basically said, you know, "I'll give you some things, you know, that you wouldn't otherwise be able to have. I'll give you, you know, some treats from the candy store. I'll give you these things if you, you know, pick some cotton for me." And that became the rest of her life from the age of six. And her family was so destitute that they actually couldn't protest that. Aside from the threat of protesting, period, they actually had to rely on all 20 of their children to make ends meet. And so she became trapped in this system for most of her life. She married a man named Pap Hamer, and they lived in basically a shack with no running water. Sometimes she worked as a domestic, and the landowner's dog actually had a running toilet, whereas the people who lived in the town did not. And any attempts that her family made to advance were met with violence. At one point, her father tried to buy his own land and sort of, you know, make something for himself. He bought three mules. And at night, white night riders, they called them, came and poisoned the mules, and they died. These immense challenges to blacks mounting an overt resistance, I think, illustrate why there wasn't more resistance in Mississippi, although far from none. But I also think it's important to recognize that lack of resistance should not ever be equated with acceptance of the status quo. And in one example from her childhood, Hamer described how her mother reprimanded her for suggesting that the exploitation and inferior conditions that blacks endured were a product of their own blackness. And she said, quote, "Being a very small child, I thought it was because of our color that made something wrong. I remember telling my mother one day, I said, 'Mother, how come we are not white? Because white people have clothes, they can have food to eat, and we work all the time and we don't have anything.' She said, 'I don't ever want to hear you say that again, honey. Don't say that because you are black.' She said, 'You respect yourself as a little child, a little black child, and as you grow older, respect yourself as a black woman. Then one day other people will respect you.'" In other words, Hamer's mother instilled in her a sense of self-worth and a refusal to accept the conditions that blacks faced in the South as somehow natural rather than something imposed on them by the system of Jim Crow and justified by white supremacy. So these were the conditions that foregrounded Hamer's entry into the movement. And in 1962, she ended up going to a meeting at a local church that had been called by civil rights advocates in order to educate the community about the right to vote and how to get registered. In fact, Hamer was pretty reluctant initially to even attend this meeting. She basically wrote it off. She said, you know, they taught us that whole mess in school about voting, you know, whatever, whatever, it doesn't make a difference. But at the urging of a family friend, she decided to go. And there she was inspired by the activists who talked about how black people had the right to vote despite all the ways their rights were denied in the South, and why asserting this right would bring the promise of change to Mississippi. When the meeting organizers asked who would be willing to go to the courthouse that we can try to register, Hamer raised her hand. So before I continue with Hamer's story, I want to zoom out a little bit and talk about what was happening in this period, because there's a bigger context, I think, for people's hope for change and a sort of momentum that was happening around the country. Like black people elsewhere, Mississippi blacks were inspired by the Brown versus Board of Education decision outlawing segregation in schools, the Montgomery bus boycott, the sit-ins, the freedom rides, and other signs at the level of national politics that seemed to be pushing greater momentum in support of civil rights. And a major turning point was actually World War II, where black veterans, including in the South, came back from fighting abroad in quotes for democracy, only to come back and face immense segregation, immense repression, immense racism at home. That inspired people to begin to try to resist, even as the South fought back. And another aspect was President Kennedy's victory, which was partly based on the migration I mentioned earlier of blacks moving northward. So they became this voting bloc, essentially, that the party had to actually respond to. But there's a contradiction in that, which is that the Democratic Party, as we all know, is also the party of slavery. In the South, they're the Dixiecrats. They're actually a party that is fundamentally, at its core, devoted to segregation. And so the National Party is trying to do a balancing act of both placating and talking civil rights, and at the same time doing very little to actually force the South to comply. As I said, even without federal intervention, Mississippi saw the writing on the wall and they dug in. So a few examples of that. James Meredith was a student who attempted to integrate the University of Mississippi, and the Kennedy administration actually had to send in federal marshals because there was such a massive riot, and two people were actually killed in this riot, trying to prevent him from desegregating the school. And the growth of the KKK exploded in Mississippi for the first time since the 1930s. They suddenly had 5,000 members. In this sense, with all these contradictions nationally and in the South, Mississippi presented the clearest example of how little the moderate strategy of waiting on the courts had achieved to chip away at segregation in the face of such a unified resistance to, you know, this federal call to desegregate Mississippi's institutions. So the stakes for personal involvement in the movement were really high, and that came down on Fannie Lou Hamer from the minute that she raised her hand and attempted to go to the courthouse. So when she came back from trying to register to vote, she was immediately fired from the plantation she had worked on for 18 years. When the white plantation owner insisted that she take her name off the voting rolls, Hamer responded, "I didn't go down there to register for you. I went down to register for myself." This decision impacted not just her, but her family. Soon after, her husband, Pap Hamer, was also evicted from the plantation, and neither of them could find work because of Hamer's involvement with the movement. And they were constantly harassed by authorities. There's one point where Hamer actually received a $9,000 water bill, even though her house had no running water. In another incident, Knight Riders actually fired shots into the home of a family she'd been staying at, and luckily she was no longer staying there because the bullets actually hit the spot where her head would have been if she was sleeping in the house. So despite all of these threats, Hamer chose to stay with the movement. And I think it just illustrates a small example of what it means to overcome fear. Like, when she made that decision, even what she said, a black woman in the South, to her, you know, her boss, I think was a way of overcoming fear. And, you know, you can't take that away from people. There's a way that that propels people to move forward. So equally important, I think, was the fact that acts of courage like Hamer's were not done in isolation, but in the context of growing organization. And there was an organization that had developed that allowed new people to plug into the movement, and, you know, was actually oriented on how do we get as many people to participate as we possibly can. And you can't separate this story of Hamer's life from the impact of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, known as SNCC. So Hamer herself stated that, quote, "If SNCC hadn't have come to Mississippi, there never would have been a Fannie Lou Hamer. They treated me like a human being, whether the kids was white or black. I was respected with the kids, and they never told nobody what to say. This is what's been there all the time, and we had a chance to get it off our chests, and nobody else had ever given us that chance. They brought every hope into the state of Mississippi." So the SNCC was organized out of the student sit-ins that swept the South in 1960, and they were known for their immense courage and an anti-hierarchical style of organizing. Basically, SNCC was hoping by going to the South, they would tap the, you know, energy that was happening around the country in order to bring even the most backward sections of the country into the movement. And if they could do it in Mississippi, they'd be able to do it anywhere. So from the beginning, they were among the most militant of the civil rights organizations, and they were willing to take direct action, unlike some of the more moderate, legalistic organizations like the NAACP. And it's equally important that their commitment and approach to grassroots organizing meant that they didn't want to just come in as outsiders and then say, you know, let's go and tell people what to do. They actually wanted to create local leadership. They wanted to inspire and invigorate people to actually lead for themselves. Basically, you couldn't just do that as an outsider. You actually had to have local people, someone who was facing the same consequences as you for sticking out their necks. And that was what Hamer represented. When they found her, it was like, oh my God, this is the most amazing person, and she's the perfect person for this kind of job. And they really took to her. So another step back, I think, is they could have gone to the South, but why voter registration? You know, they could have done almost anything, really, and I think it's important to raise that, because that wasn't an inevitable decision that would be the specific tactic that they used. So one part of it is the near total inability of blacks to vote. Even if you tried to register, they would post your name in the local newspaper for 2 weeks. And if for a black person, that meant, you know, someone could come and kill you or to come and try to threaten you. So that was, you know, the way that they kept after Reconstruction. And then also there were quote unquote legal methods that, you know, were actually illegal, like a poll tax or literacy test, all kinds of things that Mississippi had written into law to kind of, you know, solidify this inability of blacks to get the vote. But the other thing was, I think it had an appeal in a society where political power was just so denied, to say, you know, what does it mean that the uncle of the brother of the person who murdered Emmett Till is on the police force? What if we could vote that man out? So, you know, just to say how strong that appeal was for people. But there's also the fact that this decision was made partly based on an effort by the Kennedy administration to co-opt the movement. They were doing freedom rides. They were doing things that stopped, you know, that completely stopped the buses, that stopped the businesses from running, that were incredibly disruptive, and were really calling national and international attention at a time when there was, you know, independence movements by black countries that, you know, were looking at the U.S. that calls itself a democracy and seeing what was actually happening. And so they couldn't have that. They didn't want that attention. And so Robert Kennedy actually approached SNCC and said, you know, I'll give you a tax exemption if you cut that crap and go do voter registration in the South. So there was an effort to contain the more radical elements of the movement right from the start. And I think these things had a contradictory effect. That's, I think, important to note. And at the same time, I think what voter registration did was it gave SNCC an opportunity to connect to local people like Hamer. It gave them an opportunity to teach them direct action training. So they didn't just abandon the idea that we can only do voter registration or we can do direct action. They actually ended up deciding to do both in tandem. And as I said, Hamer proved to be among the most important contacts that SNCC met, and she became a full-time organizer. Now, Hamer was 44 years old at this time. She is not what we usually think of when we think of the civil rights movement, which is, you know, young people, very young people taking action. She had a sixth grade education because the education system in Mississippi was so absolutely decrepit. They spent less on black people, and many people actually had to leave in order to go to work and work in the cotton fields. So she was not, you know, like a Martin Luther King who had a very, you know, who was middle class and had this education, or like many of the people from the NAACP. And she didn't speak properly. She didn't speak proper grammar. And all of this at the same time made her the best representative of ordinary Southern blacks. On the plantation, she had been a timekeeper, which meant that she was really playing a leading role on the plantation in negotiating on behalf of other sharecroppers and, when necessary, intervening to ensure that white plantation bosses didn't screw them over. So she was already well respected in the community and well known, and she coupled this experience with what turned out to be exceptional talent as an organizer and mobilizer. She could get people to just like empty their pockets for the movement or overcome their fear and attempt to get on the voting rolls, and allowed, you know, a constant flood of local people to come into her house in and out as the movement progressed, sometimes even, you know, against the wishes of her husband at times. And you can't talk about Fannie Lou Hamer without talking about her voice. Almost every single person who knew about Hamer in this movement, the first thing they mentioned is Hamer's voice. She was remembered not so much even for the specifics of what she said, but just the way that her voice was able to rouse people around her to action. And she would sing. She was, you know, in a movement that was so into singing, or where song played such a crucial organizing role. She was a singer. She actually toured with the Freedom Singers at one point. I probably won't have time to, you know what, I'm going to do it anyway, because I, you have to hear how she sounded. So I have a clip here of Hamer. So she's telling people, if you are born in America with a black face, you were born in the mess. You can't escape the mess just by saying, I'm not going to get involved. Another example is, on a return trip from her first attempt at registering to vote, the police stopped the bus and arrested the driver because, and I kid you not, the bus was too yellow, too similar to a school bus. And the people on the bus, you know, were engaged in probably their first political action ever. And so people started to panic. You know, what about my obligations back home? What happens if I get arrested? What if I go to jail? And Hamer did something that she would do all the time, that she became known for. She starts singing. She sings, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." She sings "This Little Light of Mine," and gradually the others start singing with her. And the singing helped them to regain their courage and a sense of purpose. And she was deeply aware of this role. She could spontaneously change the lyrics to a song, you know, or, you know, kind of try to meet the moment with people and convince them to keep going forward. So it's nearly impossible to overstate the level of violence in Mississippi that civil rights workers and local blacks faced from the Jim Crow establishment. And Hamer got her own taste of that in Winona. In June of 1963, Hamer and her fellow civil rights workers were traveling home from a civil rights training in Charleston, South Carolina. And when the bus stopped in Winona, Mississippi, several passengers got out to use the whites-only cafe and restrooms. But they were stopped by a cop and a highway patrolman who ordered them to leave. In fact, this was common practice for freedom riders to test out the interstate commerce laws that were supposed to protect them from discrimination, but which, in fact, local authorities ignored. And again, SNCC is contacting, the FBI is contacting Kennedy, is saying, won't you send someone? Because we can't do this. We can't even register people if you won't protect us or give us protection. And they never respond. When one of the SCLC staffers, Anel Ponder, started to write down the cop's license plate number, he just went into a rage and placed them all under arrest. And Hamer had been on the bus this whole time while this was happening, and she came out to ask the group, do you want me to go back to Greenwood's so that I can tell the others what happened? And he arrested her on the spot. What happened next turned out to be the most brutal beating of her life, a story she would take all the way to the Democratic National Convention. The officers forced one of the black inmates being held in the Winona jail to beat Hamer with a blackjack, saying, "I want you to make that bitch wish she was dead," and threatening him if he refused. Hamer described how the man, quote, "beat me until he give out," and how at one point her skirt started to ride up, and when she tried to pull it down, the officer pulled it back up and joined in the beating, kicking her in the head. When she tried to get up, she nearly passed out, but the officers insisted she could walk. After this, she was not able to sleep on her back for weeks. In fact, she suffered physical complications from the beating for the rest of her life. She had kidney issues, she lost vision in one eye. Somehow, even after all of this, she managed to keep up the resolve of the other workers, of the other, you know, civil rights workers, including those who were also beaten in jail, leading them in freedom songs while they were in the prison. So it's not too speculative to say that they were probably saved a worse fate because of the ingenuity of the SNCC workers who, when they realized that she wasn't home, they called every one of the police stations locally and basically bluffed. They're like, "We have the FBI watching. We have all these people here. You know, get them. Get, you know, we know you have them." And they ultimately found them that way. And upon their release, all but the youngest, 15-year-old June Johnson, were fined for disorderly conduct and resisting arrest. And after that, an all-white jury was eventually acquitted the officers of all charges.
You're listening to Haley Pessin on the radical legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
So events like these may have personally steeled the resolve of SNCC workers to fight Jim Crow, but it was also obviously incredibly devastating to be up against just this wall of violence and with no national attention on what was going on. So they ended up changing their strategy. And this was partly in response to local and national events. I mean, this is just a sample of the violence that was happening. You have Medgar Evers being killed, the head of the national NAACP. Birmingham is happening. Martin Luther King is leading protesters against dogs and fire hoses and being beaten back by the police. And the Kennedy administration is being forced finally to actually come out forcefully with a statement in support of civil rights. And still nothing is happening in Mississippi. So by the spring of 1965, despite all these efforts, despite, you know, some progress, only 1.1% of the black population was registered in Sunflower County, where Hamer lived, compared to 80% of eligible whites. So the shift in strategy had sort of two prongs. One was to get the struggle to actually be all across Mississippi. And what they did is they did a freedom ballot. Because blacks could not register for the regular ballot without enormous threat to their lives, they had a freedom ballot, which basically was open to everyone, was anonymous, wouldn't be published in the papers, and they wanted to prove that blacks were not participating because they couldn't. If given the opportunity, they would be on the front lines of this. And they got 80,000 people to come out, a majority of whom were unregistered blacks. Ultimately, the campaign laid the basis for the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, or the MFDP, which I'll refer back to in a minute. The other prong of this was Freedom Summer. They felt, after, you know, quite a lot of debate, that the only way the nation would pay attention to this problem, the only way, was if it wasn't just black people dying, if it wasn't just black people facing this violence, they needed to bring white volunteers as well. And so they put a call out across the country, and they were absolutely overwhelmed with this response. They ended up bringing 1,000 white volunteers into Mississippi to work alongside of SNCC. And the, you know, argument was that this is the only way we can get national intervention. And unfortunately, that proved to be true far more quickly than they would have thought. The most famous instance of this is when the civil rights workers Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney were killed. They were, you know, abducted, and their bodies ended up being found. And during the search for their bodies, they actually found the bodies of black civil rights workers whose deaths had not received any national attention whatsoever. And in this context, the MFDP became the vehicle for pushing this challenge nationally. So the strategy for the MFDP was to elect delegates on the basis of this freedom ballot, again, open to everyone regardless of race, and attempt to unseat the all-white Mississippi Democrats delegation, which they argued was illegitimate because all of the tactics they'd used made it so that blacks couldn't participate. So how could these people possibly represent Mississippi, a majority black state? In fact, not only was the regular delegation all white, they were staunchly segregationist to the point of defying the National Democratic Party's shift towards civil rights. They were against any kind of civil rights bill. They were totally blunt in their opposition. At this point, MFDP went in with very high hopes because of the response they'd gotten that they would be able to actually unseat these people. If only they could get the nation to understand what was happening, if we could expose this problem, people will come in and actually, listen to us and help us. They actually had a pretty, for the time, radical platform. It's a reformist platform, but it had demands like making sure that there was an end to segregation in all state facilities, making it a crime to intimidate voters, establishing a low-interest loan program for small farmers and integrating all of the public schools and making sure there were more black people hired to public services. And the 68-person delegation was remarkably representative. One summer volunteer described it. It was just a cross-section of the community. There were sharecroppers. There were factory workers. These were the delegates that all went to Atlantic City for the Democratic National Convention. And this, from the establishment's perspective, was supposed to just go really smoothly. This was a convention that was supposed to be essentially the coronation of Lyndon B. Johnson. We're going to unite the party. There's not going to be any, fuss, and he's going to be the nominee. Again, this is based on a coalition between people in the North who are getting the civil rights rhetoric and the Dixiecrats in the South who are, staunchly segregationists. So what actually ends up happening is the MFDP delegates and their supporters made their case for challenging the Mississippi regulars before a 110-person credentials committee. And the highlight ended up being Hamer's testimony, in which she recounted the loss of her job, the brutal beating she suffered at the hands of Winona police. And Johnson was so scared of what she might say that he actually called a press conference impromptu so that the cameras would turn away from Hamer for really no reason. Even the media was kind of like, what on earth is going on? But luckily, they ended up deciding to air it anyway. And what a national audience heard Hamer say was this, quote, "If the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off the hooks because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America?" Immediately, there were phone calls and telegrams flooding in from all over the country in support of seating the Freedom Democrats. But the MFDP was subject to sabotage from the highest officials of the Democratic Party, not just in terms of this press conference, but really it is utterly stunning to read the extent to which they went to try to sabotage and undermine what was seen as, a left-wing challenge within the party. They got a black congressman to befriend the activists and ended up getting the list of delegates who were supporting the challengers, and every one of the delegates got a call saying, if you do this, your job is on the line. We'll get rid of, we won't get rid of the loans that you have to pay. They actually used COINTELPRO, the famous COINTELPRO program that the FBI would later use to undermine and assassinate black power activists, to spy on the delegation. And Walter Reuther, the president of the United Auto Workers, even called Martin Luther King, who was supportive of the challengers, and threatened to cut funding for the SCLC if he didn't just, line up behind Johnson. So ultimately, the administration ends up offering them a two-seat compromise, by which they meant they would give them two seats. We'd still seat the segregationist delegation, but we'll give you two seats, but you also can't pick who's going to be on the two seats. We're going to pick for you so that it won't be, someone like Hamer. And the MFDP was under immense pressure from all these civil rights organizations who were saying, Goldwater's going to win. You know, he's going to win if you don't get in line. And they saw all these tactics and they actually rejected the challenge. They rejected the so-called compromise. And Hamer put it best. She says, "We didn't come all this way for no two seats." Instead, they actually protested. At one point, some of the delegates were able to get in, and they occupied the seats until federal officials had to take them out. And Johnson would go away from this, trying to claim credit for civil rights and the Voting Rights Acts that followed, part of appeasing this growing wing of the civil rights movement. But the experience of the MFDP disillusioned SNCC and many local activists by revealing that racism was not just a Mississippi problem, it was a national problem. As SNCC's Cleveland Sellers put it, quote, "Never again were we lulled into believing that our task was exposing injustices so that the good people of America could eliminate them. We left Atlantic City with the knowledge that our movement had turned into something else. After Atlantic City, our struggle was not for civil rights, but for liberation." So this is obviously very powerful, but there was no clear way forward from there. I think that one of the challenges was people went in with these high hopes and went in hoping that they would be heard and really were just completely disillusioned. And so activists went in many different directions trying to grapple with this. Some of them ended up running for elected office. Some of them ended up becoming part of the Black Power movement. And Mississippi, in a way, was sort of left to try to figure out a way forward on its own. So I want to, kind of begin to end by talking about Hamer's actual politics, which I think is the thing that gets left out the most. She shared SNCC's criticism of racism, and I think even after these experiences, was not disabused of the idea that running for office would be a way of bettering conditions for Black people. And she ran many different times in her life. She ran for Congress. But she also saw this meant nothing without popular power and grassroots support behind it. Moreover, racism for Hamer was not a problem unique to the South, something made even clearer by the experience of the MFDP in 1964. In response to the wave of riots that swept the nation in 1968, when people were really denouncing Black, people who were beginning to rebel, Hamer responded, quote, "Mississippi is not actually Mississippi's problem. Mississippi is America's problem." As the movement moved towards Black power and the issue of separatism ultimately became a major point of departure for SNCC, they ended up expelling whites from the organization. Hamer maintained her insistence on the importance of solidarity and of whites in the movement. She said, quote, "If we are going to try to break down the barrier of segregation, we can't segregate ourselves. None of us is free until all of us are free." Even after her break with SNCC over its ejection of whites from the organization, she maintained her dedication to mass movement work and grassroots organizing. There's an anecdote from when she was running for Congress that I really love, from a lawyer who was basically advising her during their attempt to unseat. She and two other women from the Delta were running to try to unseat five congressmen who had been elected essentially because of the suppression of the Black vote. And what happened was she called up the lawyer late at night saying, you have to come. We're going to do a community organizing meeting. You need to make sure that people in the community understand what is going on. And the lawyer didn't really want to come. And she said, listen, this is the most important thing. And so he comes to the organizing meeting, and there are three people there. And she says, three is better than none. And she understood the importance of using every opportunity as an organizing tool, not waiting on the legal system to act on their behalf, because organizing the community to act was what she called, quote, more important than anything that goes on in that courtroom. Throughout the rest of her life, Hamer became active in virtually every front that related to fighting racism and for the rights of Blacks locally as well as nationally. And I'm not going to have time to go into everything she did. Honestly, I don't think anyone would. It is such a rich history, and I hope people are inspired to read even more about her life. But she spoke out against the Vietnam War long before many other leading figures of the movement were willing to do so. She toured college campuses supporting the fight for Black studies. Once she was at Harvard, and she was asked, like, are you part of the left? And she says, yes, I've been left 400 years. And I think there's a pretty big debate today, actually. You know, some of it comes within the Democratic Party, but it's also quite relevant to the left, that tends to counterpose identity politics and the question of oppression to questions of economic justice. And Hamer really makes clear that there is no separation between those things. She spent time fighting with the Freedom Union. There's actually, after the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, sort of little known history, is there was a Mississippi Freedom Union, which organized sharecroppers, day laborers, and domestic workers, and they actually went on strike, you know, at the height of this movement in Mississippi. She was part of an alliance with liberal feminists. Hamer, I don't think, would have considered herself a feminist. She had some pretty, regressive views on things like abortion rights, but I think coming from a situation where she herself was sterilized against her will needs to be put in that context. But she refused in that context to condemn black men in the movement and say that this is the problem, as many feminists of the time did. She, you know, saw that the fight against racism and the fight, you know, for women's rights needed to be linked in some way. And I think that really she speaks to what we now know as intersectional feminism in a pretty profound way before it was organized as, you know, more of a theory or more of a method. And finally, one of her most important projects was a freedom farm. It was a black cooperative aimed at providing for various needs of impoverished people within the community, including poor whites. And she bought 40 acres on which people were provided with food, clothing, and housing, and training for farmers to secure FHA loans. I can't go into the whole history of how it was demised, but ultimately the mechanization, the fact that sharecropping was really a system that was on the decline, you know, from an economic standpoint, was no longer viable in the South. And the fact really that this was not a project, it was, you know, what people called a parallel institution. It wasn't aimed at dismantling capitalism or the, you know, conditions of exploitation and oppression. It was an attempt to kind of get around it. There are many limitations to that, but what I think is really critical about it is that it was an effort to grapple with something that's still really relevant today, which is how do we rely on ourselves? How do we not end up getting funding from the government and all the strings attached to that? And that, I think, is the question she was trying to grapple with. So the end of Hamer's life is pretty dismal, unfortunately. It's one of the saddest periods of her life. She ended up, you know, sort of paralleling the decline of the movement in terms of her own life. She ended up, you know, having breast cancer and suffering from actually some of the conditions she, you know, endured during the beating in Winona. And her daughter, her adopted daughter, ended up suffering complications from malnutrition in childhood, which plagued many Mississippi blacks, and they couldn't find a hospital that would take blacks, and she ended up dying. Hamer herself ended up only living to 59, and when she died, she had not a penny to her name. You know, she wasn't someone who rose to national prominence and then maintained stature. She actually died really in poverty. And the battle over her legacy began immediately at the funeral. There were 300 people packed into this funeral. And then there were hundreds of people outside who, against the wishes of the family, were not let in to the funeral. These were the ordinary people who really Hamer had always stood for. The primary beneficiaries of the black freedom struggle were the black middle class, but not the more radical demands or the, you know, the majority of ordinary black people. Moreover, as the MFDP's experience exemplifies, the Democratic Party acted on the one hand to suppress left-wing challenges from within the party and at the same time worked to co-opt the movement. There's a common perception that the movement got serious when it got out of the streets, meaning running candidates within the Democratic Party, meaning, you know, basically focusing almost entirely on elections. But I think this history shows that the way the movement was able to topple Jim Crow and pressure politicians to act when they preferred to drag their feet was not at the ballot box, but through masses of people taking direct action and getting organized to pursue their own interests. And they did so regardless of who was in office. Ultimately, leaders like Hamer were never acting alone. As John Dittmer points out, quote, wherever one looked in Mississippi in the 1960s, women were in the forefront of the movement. Fannie Lou Hamer is but the most widely acclaimed of a generation of women who influenced the course of the black struggle and later the women's liberation movement. So I agree with that, and nevertheless, I think it matters that she was willing to be among the first to step forward at a time when the stakes of the fight for racial justice had intensified, and despite personal sacrifice, her courage was contagious. The phrase that she's most known for, I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, is actually written on her gravestone. And I think those are not words of despair. They're really the place from which people should be motivated to action. And I'm going to give the last words to Fannie Lou Hamer. This comes from a 1972 interview in the years just before this downturn in the movement away from the streets. And I think it really beautifully encapsulates her legacy, what it means to be on the right side of history, and where change actually comes from, not from the top, but from the bottom. She said, quote, "Ain't nothing going to be handed to you on a silver platter. Nothing. That's not just for black people. That's people in general. The masses. See, I'm with the masses. So you don't ever get nothing, just walk up and say, here it is. You've got to fight. Every step of the way, you've got to fight."
That was Haley Payson speaking on the radical legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. You will now hear Fannie Lou Hamer speaking at the Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City, New Jersey, on August 22, 1964.
On June the 9th, 1963, I had attended a voter registration workshop, was returning back to Mississippi. 10 of us was traveling by the Continental Trailway bus. When we got to Winona, Mississippi, which is Montgomery County, 4 of the people got off to use the washroom, and 2 of the people to use the restaurant. 2 of the people wanted to use the washroom. The 4 people that had gone in to use the restaurant was ordered out. During this time, I was on the bus. But when I looked through the window and saw they had rushed out, I got off of the bus to see what had happened. And one of the ladies said it was a state highway patrolman and a chief of police ordered us out. I got back on the bus, and one of the persons who had used the washroom got back on the bus too. As soon as I was seated on the bus, I saw when they began to get the 5 people in a highway patrolman's car. I stepped off of the bus to see what was happening, and somebody screamed from the car that the fire workers was in and said, "Get that one there." And when I went to get in the car, when the man told me I was under arrest, he kicked me. I was carried to the county jail and put in the booking room. They left some of the people in the booking room and began to place us in cells. I was placed in a cell with a young woman called Miss Yvester Simpson. After I was placed in the cell, I began to hear sounds of licks and screams. I could hear the sounds of licks and horrible screams. And I could hear somebody say, "Can you say yes, sir, nigga? Can you say yes, sir?" And they would say other horrible names. She would say, "Yes, I can say yes, sir." So I said, she said, "I don't know you well enough." They beat her I don't know how long. And after a while, she began to pray and ask God to have mercy on those people. And it wasn't too long before 3 white men came to my cell. One of these men was a state highway patrolman. And he asked me where I was from. And I told him Roosevelt. He said, "We're going to check this." And they left my cell, and it wasn't too long before they came back. He said, "You are from Roosevelt, all right." And he used a curse word. And he said, "We're going to make you wish you was dead." I was carried out of that cell into another cell where they had 2 Negro prisoners. The state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro to take the blackjack. The first Negro prisoner ordered me, by orders from the state highway patrolman, for me to lay down on a bunk bed on my face. And I laid on my face. The first Negro began to beat. And I was beat by the first Negro until he was exhausted. I was holding my hands behind me at that time on my left side, because I suffered from polio when I was 6 years old. After the first Negro had beat until he was exhausted, The state highway patrolman ordered the second Negro to take the blackjack. The second Negro began to beat, and I began to work my feet. And the state highway patrolman ordered the first Negro had beat to sit on my feet, to keep me from working my feet. I began to scream, and one white man got up and began to beat me in my head and tell me to hush. One white man, my dress had worked up high. He walked over and pulled my dress. I pulled my dress down, and he pulled my dress back up. I was in jail when Medgar Evers was murdered. All of this is on account of we want to register to become first-class citizens. And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
That was the voice of Fannie Lou Hamer. Before that, you heard Haley Payson speaking on the radical legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer. She spoke in Chicago. Haley Payson is a member of the International Socialist Organization. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are independent and part of the nonprofit media education organization, Rise Up. We are supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature progressive voices rarely heard in the media, such as Chris Hedges, Angela Davis, David Stannard, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, Eric Holt-Jimenez, Ralph Nader, and Yanis Varoufakis. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for CDs, MP3s, or written transcripts of today's program, Haley Payson, on the radical legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, call us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our website, alternativeradio.org. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Fannie Lou Hamer singing Go Tell It on the Mountain, recorded at a mass meeting in Greenwood, Mississippi in 1963.
Go tell it on the mountain.